You're listening to Mike and Kristen,
the podcast.
I'm Mike, a musician, writer, and producer.
And I'm Kristen, a painter, writer, and designer.
Our show is all about following dreams, taking chances, and what life as an artist is really about.
Together, we bring you weekly guest interviews and thought-provoking conversations.
Let's go! Hello, Kristen. What is going on? Another episode of Mike and Kristen here. And this week we have Rankin McGinnis, the great, amazing, talented performer, awesome guy, on to chat about his life, his career, all the things he's up to.
And a fellow Cape Bretoner.
Yes, he is Mabooer. 15 minutes away from where I grew up.
Is that the official title for folks from Mabo?
Mabooian.
Mabooian? No. Abooey?
I think it's Mabooer. That's what he always said.
Yeah, no, I like that.
I think most small towns just add "er" on, don't they?
I'm a Clarencer.
Yeah,
Bridge. That works.
Yeah, Bridge Towner.
Yeah, Clarencer.
It seems like cities is where they get into fancy things. But yeah, the small town, you just add the "er" on. A little shetty camper there.
And Canadians in general just add the "a" on the end of everything.
Yeah.
"Ers" and "a's" there, we've defined it. It was so fun to really sit down with Rankin and get to know him better. We've been to lots of his shows. You've participated as the town heroes in one of his winter warmer shows.
Multiple times.
We talk about a lot in this episode, him bringing together Rankin's winter warmers. It's been so successful. But seeing more of his inspiration and getting to know him as the leader of all of this was really cool.
He's someone who just, he's always smiling. He's always, people are drawn to him because he's just a happy guy. Lots of energy coming off him. And he, even if he wasn't a musician, he'd probably have a lot of people who are just in his circle because he's just a nice guy to be around.
Yeah, he's got that magnetism to him. But I would say that's what people see on the outside. Having this conversation with him really reveals the amount of effort behind the scenes that goes into producing this work of art that he has.
Yeah, every week, Rankin's Winter Warmers in the winter is a big production where people go and see the show, which is an amazing show, multiple guests every week. But the work that happens behind the scenes to learn all the guest songs, to be on top of that and to pull it all together is a big thing.
He's put so much effort into building a community, and not just within the musicians that he shares the stage with, but with the guests that attend the shows. You really feel like you are part of a family when you're there. And people go every week to see these shows that they're family friendly. They're in the afternoon. He just makes it really accessible for everyone to go and have a good time together.
Yeah, he's a good-natured Cape Breton boy spreading that through what he does really well, which is music. And Rankin can play a lot of different instruments, too. I don't know if we ever got into that in the conversation, but he started off playing bagpipes and piano, and he can play a lot of stringed instruments. He'll whip out something you're not expecting at different times. And he's a talented guy, and yeah, just he brings a lot of fun to what he's doing.
Brings a lot of fun and just bringing people together, really, which I think is a great time to introduce this week's Thoughts and Things.
Thoughts and Things, Thoughts and Things, Thoughts and Things, Thoughts and Things.
The quote I have for this week is none other than Helen Keller as the spokeswoman. And she said, "Alone, we can do so little. Together, we can do so much."
That is short and sweet and very powerful.
Well, and it feels relevant to the vision that Rankin has achieved. I think we're all quite capable, and it's important to see your own individualistic strengths and what you can bring to the table. But he recognizes not only the power, but the fun in bringing people together and creating this community that everyone gets to share and travel together and have input on and collaborate creatively. And then the audience then becomes part of this experience as well. It's just this synergy that keeps growing and growing.
And being a part of a community is one of the most powerful things in being human. There's the study that we were looking up recently, which talks about how there's a large, large part of the population which is considered lonely now.
So this is a Harvard study that has been running since 1938, I want to say. Yeah. It's one of the longest running academic studies in the world, if not the longest. And it showed that this idea of building relationships and community is the number one factor for living a longer life.
Yeah.
So if that's not motivating, I don't know what
it is. So if you go to Rankin's Winter Warmers, you're going to live longer.
Yes, that's an accurate fact.
So Rankin needs to work that into a slogan.
Yes, when Rankin's really helping people live longer.
But I think the more occasions where you can bring joy into your life, you're just going to be a happier person, healthier person. And yeah, that's one thing that Rankin does on a consistent basis.
Totally. Well, let's hear the story direct from him, and we'll dive right into this episode and hear more from Mr. Rankin McGinnis. Do they still have thrift shops that you can get a shirt for under $40 though now? Because secondhand thrifted clothing has now become trendy. So you go in and get a shirt.
I think Frenchies, I think those bin places are still staying true to like a sweater is this, a t-shirt is this.
Yeah.
Versus this t-shirt.
Yes, that's true.
You Things have to go to rural communities where they don't know any shirt is, like you said, the same price. Like it could be whatever. What's a brand shirt? Like a designer brand.
George.
Like a Vera Wang or something. Yeah, you're looking for a designer's name. Yes. Yeah.
Like it could be a shirt worth $500, but an old nun gets it and they just put it in on the rack for 50 cents.
Yeah, Value Village is expensive.
Village has gone up for sure.
I don't know. Anyways, I digress. We don't need to talk about secondhand clothes, but I am wearing your winter warmer sweater, which is what inspired this conversation in the first place.
Oh my God. So speaking of that, there is a still cheap place in Mabu.
Hope Chest?
The Hope Chest. And so when we did those, it was after the series. And so everybody was just by order. And so it was like, what do you want? What size t-shirt, blah, blah, blah. And there was only a couple people that got like a female cut. And so I knew exactly who had the mall. And Mom went to the Hope Chest, and there was one of my winter warmers. And it was a female cut, and it was my aunt's.
Oh no. She had donated it.
Did you ever call her out?
Not yet.
On live on air. She's live on air.
We've seen our stuff, too.
Bunch of aunts, though, so.
Yeah.
You've seen Town Heroes shirts at Value Village, haven't you?
I've seen
my leggings there,
CDs.
Too.
Yeah. Senior CD there is a weird moment in history. You're wondering, is this a positive thing? Like, I sold so many CDs that they ended up in Valley Village. Or it's like, oh yeah, this sucked, so they just got rid of it.
Well, you could also be like, maybe it wasn't my fault. Maybe they died.
Yeah, that's most of stuff there.
This is our positive spin on it. The owner of this item must have died. It's the only reason they'd get rid of my merch.
People don't know, most of the stuff you get from those places is from dead people. But I like that, you know? Someone lived a good life.
Unfortunately. My aunt's still alive, so she just didn't like the shirt.
We can edit anything out, Rankin, through the interview.
No, there's no unfortunate.
I think it's... I actually love that shirt.
I get a lot of compliments on this shirt. It's kind of interactive, so it's got everyone's... Mm. So I actually am curious about the design of it. Did you take just profile shots of all of your bandmates? And
They're all like... Most of those are what the artists would have submitted to me for there. And if they didn't, I would just steal one that I liked.
Yeah.
In my earlier days, I'd say a cowboy with graphic design where I'm just... out in the field and just trying to figure it out on my own when I have to. So then I just was trying buttons. I didn't know what threshold was, but basically it will two-tone it like black and white. So I just got in the habit of doing for those release of promo, wasn't somebody's profile pic. It was like this two-tone in the stars thing. Mm-hmm. So at the end, I just would have spent hours and hours just moving everybody around and sizing them up to try to make it fit exactly. When I do something, when I feel like it's done is when I can look at it almost like glossy-eyed, where I just see the shapes and do the shapes make sense. So I would have edited that over long period of time, almost cross-eyed, just moving people's faces around.
I feel like musicians gain a lot of skills, not intentionally, but because they have to do things. Like, oh, I have to go make this graphic. And by the end of it, like now you're basically a graphic designer. Yeah. Like just by chance, because you're making t-shirts, you're making videos, you're doing all these things to promote your shows and what you have on the go. So you develop this skill set that when you go into it, playing guitar or piano, bagpipes, whatever you play, it's not at all on your mind, but it becomes a very prominent thing.
Yeah, 100%. If there's a need, it has to be filled.
Yeah.
So do you look at music the same as you just described the glossy-eyed looking at this sweater in This Is How I Know the Song Is Complete?
I think so. Like when I'm listening through, basically, instead of going glossy-eyed, I'll be like, closed eyes and dancing. Does anything throw off the dance or anything make my brow furrow? So I'll go from the beginning of the song over and over and over again. And if there's spots that I hear, you know, you might not hear them the second time and you might forget about them, but essentially my brain knows where that spot's going to come up. And so I will do the zoned out dance, and until I get rid of all those little moments, whether it usually will be one instrument at a time. And it's totally for placement of arrangement and feel and groove first, and then I'll start again and do it kind of for the mix second. But yeah, it's the same thing where I just have to dance and make me dance till the end. Otherwise, I'm going to repeat, repeat, repeat.
I just finished a presentation course. So they're teaching you how to do public speaking or on a Zoom call or something like that. And they taught this idea of when you're practicing a presentation, not to start and do beginning to end every single time, because maybe it's the middle or three quarters of the way that really needs work.
Yeah.
Do you guys do that with your songs?
I'd say when you know what part you're focused on, like say if there's, you know, like I know I'm doing drum edits or something, I would just be in a small section repeating that over. But it's like when I do start to end, it's where it's like it's supposed to be. Like all the drum editing was done, or all the any editing was done, or takes chosen, only at the end where it's supposed to be done.
That right, your final go over.
Because you might find at the 30-second mark a drum thing, and at the 47-second mark a vocal thing, or so only start to finish when it's like, please let me dance.
That's when the dance test comes in.
I think in those circumstances, feel is really important, because when I'm listening to something back, whatever, I'm like, oh, this feels right, or I can dance to it. I guess kind of a similar thing. And when something actually bothers you, there's something about how it feels like something. And that's a thing with mixing. Like when I'm listening to a song, I'm going after things. Oh, I don't like this. I don't like this. The other things that actually I like are just, they feel right. So you don't even consider them. You're going after the things that don't feel right in the end.
Focus on the negative.
And turn it into a positive.
That'll be the name of this episode.
Yeah.
Rick McGinnis. Focus on
you
the
get
negative.
Rid of those negatives until it becomes a beautiful piece that, you know, nothing bothers you. Everything feels right.
Yeah. So you're up here recording this weekend, but you're just coming off the tail end of yet another intense winter. This seems to be the time that most people hibernate, but that you're the opposite. You're out just grooving, as you said earlier. And how you feeling in between this transition?
It's good. It's funny. Like every year I tell myself I'm going to get more ahead of the ball, and I'm trying to find out what time of year that happens. And right now it's here, and then the next time will be November. But it was a great feeling to the season. It was, I think, a lot of high moments that we haven't seen before, from the support to just, you know, the band getting used to what the show is. And only the second time we've had the full actual band do the warmers. But right after the warmers, like as it's wrapping up, you know, we're still snow on the ground and all these summer festivals are putting out their lineups and tickets already. So it's like, I go right from that to being like, Blueberry Jam is tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah, it feels that way.
So I get a moment of rest and have an Easter dinner. And then I think mentally, even though it's chiller time, it's right back to the board.
How did Rankin's Winter Warmers come to be? Tell us the history behind that.
So at the time, I was playing with pretty much exclusively party boots. And, you know, everybody's focused on one thing. And I was trying to find different ways to be involved in music while just trying to find angles to try to make a career out of this choice we make. I was trying to focus on actually making an event rather than another band. Instead of having two projects I'd be trying to push around, it was like, here's an opportunity for me to do something that's just myself. And it started off very, very humbly at the locals. Me, Luke Arsenault, was on bass, and Sir Khan, I hope you said your last name right there, Sir Khan, was on drums, and it was like a trio, and every week we would have two guests come in, and it was totally, it was in the spirit of, like, you know, a session, and an Irish Celtic session, Scottish session, but of any genres, where there was no real prep. We would sit down and play stuff, try to keep it as cowboy chords or whatever as possible, and would jam out, and there'd be just, you know, at busiest 30 people there coming. But it started off as a way to start something different as an event to grow separately than a band or an act.
So what was the premise of the event itself? Like, what made that different?
The reason we chose the winter for starters was, like you said, it's usually a dead time of year. So it was like a available time where I could implement something no matter how busy you are as a musician. Like the summer, the fall is the busiest. So it was like implementing something in that time while trying to take, and the matinee too, like the thing I really liked about the Warmers always, it was intended for all ages. And that's something that we kind of grew up with in Cape Breton, where if you went to a dance, if you went to a concert, it's everybody from newborn to, you know, I don't want to put a cap on a human age here, but in their 80s, I'd say for the most part, those that, you know, might have had a sip in the back of the car, we're still at all these events and just socializing and just enjoying music in any form that you'd like to enjoy it. And it was just widely accepted. And so one of the special things I found about the Warmers was no matter, like, you know, no matter how many people were showing up, it was still at a time that was for everybody. And it was still an event that was for any genre. And even in the first year, we had, I think we had a DJ jam out with us, like with records. And then we, you know, you have folk musicians, rock, blues, hip hop, R&B, while all this different music in the spirit of, you know, a lot of cultures, but in my case, the Celtic culture of sharing music and community, I guess.
Well, we as the middle-aged fan appreciate the matinee.
That choice every year becomes juicier.
From the start, were you playing other people's songs? Like, it's grown into this big thing where the guest artists come on and you and your band learn a number of their songs. And I've been fortunate enough to be a part of it myself. And it's such a killer band. You step up and they know the song inside and out. But from the start, was that part of the premise?
It was and it wasn't. So in the beginning, like now, we're lucky to have almost every instrument an artist could want behind them to do their song. And we have a lot of singers. But in the beginning, I don't know what year it was the first time we had a singer that didn't play anything. Because the premise in the beginning was more like a session where, say, two guests, one of them was an instrumentalist always, and the other one was a singer, but that not just a singer, somebody that was very proficient on an instrument for the most part. Because they were singing a couple songs, but for the most part, it's like, jam out to something that I'll give you an easy map to. Because there was no rehearsals, there was no, some artists would send, of course, a tune beforehand, but there's no chance to go over it.
Yeah.
But we had like Eric Stephen Martin in the first year.
Yeah.
And I know for sure he sang a couple of his tunes. Willie Stratton was there in the first year, but I can't remember if he did his own tunes or just like, let's rock out some rock and blues. But it was there was always an element of like, you can do what you want. But in the beginning, it was definitely more player focused than singer writer,
and people started to take notice pretty quickly, it seems. Like, it grew
Yeah, I don't glass half full in COVID. I think it was it kind of helped the arc of that a bit. Like it grew naturally because I always believed in the event and the spirit of what it is. But during COVID, when it happened and everybody had to sit down and shows were earlier, we were already that. Yeah. People wanted tables.
Leading the charge.
Yeah. People wanted the afternoon, the tables. And so when COVID happened, it was just an event that naturally fit the rules unintentionally. I think just with that and with the limited amount of stuff going on, it just people that might have not stumbled upon it so naturally in the beginning came up. Upon it and didn't leave. Mm-hmm.
And this year you sold out the marquee every weekend?
I gotta ask. I think there was two maybe that weren't, maybe three, but for the last seven for sure.
Like, that is huge.
That's unreal.
it's a pretty humbly mind-blowing.
And how many band members are you up to now on a regular basis?
So I'd say the club is 10 and the band fielded is 8.
Okay.
But most over the year, last year, 8, but I'd say for the longest time, it'd be like natural 6 and then me on top of that showing up, I guess.
And are you adding instrumentation so that you can tailor different musician styles and songs?
No. So like I'd say out of a lot of artists around here, like we're less tour or season booked, whatever, planned, organized.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more live pretty much all the time, and everybody that's in the group are part of other groups, so it's more like who is available. So you know, on drums we got Jordan Brule, and we also have Patrick Murphy ready, and we got Brendan Melchin ready, and Shane Martin ready, and bass it's almost always Luke Arsenault, but we got Aiden Zan Roland ready, and guitars we got Luke Levy and Seamus if he's not there, we got Zach McLean ready, Tori Cameron there, she's not there. We actually, Carmen Reddy, who's probably the newest, very new, just figuring out, but we got a couple shows, second or third show that we're going to be doing this, and it's awesome to have that ready. Siobhan, Martin, Trevor, both there for keys, Trevor there for sax, James there for sax, Callan there for fiddle, if not Ian Beaton, and so it's like I'm always lucky to have somebody needy almost in every position, and you know, there's other names that didn't come off the top of the head there. I'd say it was standard 8 that usually are there first. And like I said, pretty much almost every second or third show, there'd be somebody rotating in general.
I'm glad you were able to rhyme off most of those roles, because I know that you're one, certainly publicly, to always give recognition to the whole band. Yeah. You have orchestrated this, but it seems as though you've all become a big family on stage. And I'm sure that's how you hope for it to feel, but it really does.
Yeah, and it is. I definitely feel that, and like I have to give the recognition because I don't play on my own really. Like I can, and when I do, it's usually just bagpipes and session style. But you know, I can present a nice body to this car and the keys, but that engine is that family, and even if somebody's not at the table, that's still a full table.
Yeah.
How did music come into your life in Mabu, little fella growing up in the big city of Mabu, Cape Breton?
Well, it's funny. I always give almost all the credit to my mom's side, but I shouldn't because it's equally on my father's. But I think it's just a sheer power number of the Rankins.
Yeah.
And so mom was from 13, the Backstreet Rankins beside the Rankin family. And everybody, I think, played a little bit of music growing up. And if they didn't play it, it was in the house. Like there's a piano in every house on Backstreet.
Yeah.
And so I think when all of the mom being the youngest and all the brothers and sisters went away, I think they put everybody into music right away, and everybody home too, to kind of like keep that Mabu spirit alive.
Keep
and
them out of trouble too.
Keep
right?
them out of trouble. So like we were all put into music it was very... I don't know where the theory comes from in Mabu in particular, but in general is like the best way to read. But we were all, so 5 kids, we were all put into piano first. And that's like, that's where you got your basics. And then after that, it went in order of age. It went fiddle, pipes, fiddle as your second instrument. And the middle brother, Stuart, he hated it. He hated fiddle. And he was determined to learn guitar, so he actually got guitar added into the mix, and he had to do all three for a few years till he dropped down to guitar. But it was a very ordered approach to what we learned, but we're all put into music and it all.
And Celtic was your background initially.
My first couple of years were reading was classical. It wasn't very long, 4 or 5 years into it, I would have switched into Celtic piano, but everything that I was involved with after 10 years old was Celtic, unless I was learning on my own.
Yeah. And the Gaelic College, I know you went there.
Yeah. So piano would have started with Betty Jane Cameron, Mary Ann Jewell, Jackie Dunn, and then the pipes. I would have first started with Marie McDonald and Mark Stewart and Kenneth McKenzie, my cousin. And then kind of after the individual teaching, I would have ended up at the Gaelic College, and then everything was kind of just through the Gaelic College and the pipe end after that. The Gaelic College definitely was good to me. My first job ever, my first job ever was probably before I was allowed to be working. I was 14 piping in the parking lot, and they were paying $10 an hour. They put you up, they'd feed you all your meals, and you kept all your tips. And I was making at that time like $200 to $300 a day in tips.
Man.
And I was like, geez,
14 years old.
I was like, I can't wait to make what, and when I make real money as an adult.
Yeah, this is going to triple.
I didn't realize how good I had it in those low American dollar tourist days. Jeez.
We should all go back to the Cape Breton parking lots, perhaps. And that's where the make real some money dough, is. Huh? Yeah.
You had some unique opportunities as a piper, too. I know you got to pipe in the White Stripes to their, 500th show?
Yeah.
It's Savoy Theater.
So, I didn't really know I knew Seven Nation Army at the time, and I didn't really know the whole anthology, and I wish I did. I didn't realize how cool a moment it was to be there.
Yeah.
I probably as a younger man glamorized my involvement in the show, but I was just piping them out. They're coming on and starting, but I was like, I played with the White Stripes. But it was a mind blowing show. But the funniest thing about that was before the show, I was in the parking lot and this guy came up to me and I was like, I think that's Jack White.
Yeah.
And he just gave me a Icky Thump CD. It was opened, wasn't signed. And it was just like, here, Jack wanted to give you this. I'm Jim, Jack's brother. Jack wants you to do this. Jack, blah, 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 this. Jack, and Jack wants you to do this. And I was like, oh my God, does he ever look like him? And until he walked out on stage, I was like, oh my God.
It was him.
It was him the whole time. I'm Jim, Jack's brother. Jack wants this. So he never once talked to me as Jack. It was just as Jim.
Hey, Kristen, do you know what's awesome?
Theme parks? Cotton candy?
Well, yeah, but I was going to say saving money.
Saving money is awesome.
Well, the sponsor of this week's podcast episode, Ryan O'Malley with Allstate Insurance, can help you save money with home and auto insurance.
That sounds fantastic, but I don't like dealing with call centers and talking to like 30 different people.
That's the amazing thing with Ryan. You don't have to deal with a call center. You get to speak with someone local living in Cole Harbor who knows our area, our weather, our vehicles, and our housing needs.
Ooh, I love the sound of this. And with the money we will save through bundling our insurance with Ryan, you can take me to a theme park and buy me cotton candy.
We can buy anything you want with all the money we'll save.
I'm sold. Sign me up. How can I get in touch with Allstate Insurance?
Well, you can call Ryan O'Malley at 902-210-1293 or email romalley@allstate.ca. And he's been a fantastic supporter of local arts in our podcast, so we really give the thumbs up to Ryan.
Thank you, Ryan, for helping Nova Scotians save money while protecting the things that matter to us. You already have 108 five-star reviews on Google. Prepare for even more.
Did I ever tell you about the time I met him in Nashville?
No.
My cousin James and I drove down to Nashville. We had 3 country songs we wrote. I'm like, we're going to go drive to Nashville in a shitty old car, duct taped together, and we're going to sell these songs and be rich. Like, that was our plan. So we drove to Nashville, and We had also just released Town Heroes' first CD. It's like 2010. And I had like two copies with me. And we pulled up, parked the car, walked out, and not 30 seconds in, I see Jack White on the other side of the street. I'm like, that's fucking Jack White over there. And there was a film crew behind him. I'm like, I should go say hi to him. And I knew that he was actually a Gillis. His original name is John Anthony Gillis, I believe. And he has the connections in Cape Breton. So he was on the street, and I walk up to him like, hey, Mr. Gillis, my name is Mike Ryan. I'm from Cape Breton, Nova Scotia. I'm also a musician. I play in a two-piece band myself. And yeah, I just wanted to say hi, and I wondered if you want to take a copy of my band CD. And he turns, he looks at me. The first thing he says is, do you want to be in a documentary? I'm like, can my cousin as well? And he's like, does he sound like you? I said, yeah. And he's like, okay, sure then. So he gets me and my cousin to come over, and he's making a documentary on accents for his label. So Third Man Records' label is doing this documentary. And he had this girl, I think her name was Amy Walker, maybe. She can do like any accent in the world. And she was walking around Nashville interviewing people, trying to find people with accents. So they were trying to find the deep south, the Nashville kind of the Tennessee accent. But I walked up to him and he heard me talk. And he's like, this guy will be perfect in it. So she came up and interviewed us, and the documentary is out
there.
Yeah, you
don't
have
an accent, you have a brogue.
I don't think it's an accent. I guess everyone has an accent in the end.
But this is a good story of putting yourself out there, because yeah, your intentions might have been different, but it still led to a pretty cool opportunity.
And I did give him the CD.
Did you ever watch the documentary?
I think I found part of it on YouTube. Yeah. It's out there. We'll put a link in the show notes. But anyway, the music brings about many interesting opportunities. Yeah. And yeah, getting to pipe the White Stripes into their 500th anniversary show.
Yeah, it was their second last show ever.
Yeah.
Wow.
The last of that tour, and then they did one. I wish it was the last one. That would be the best claim. Mm. But they did one more in the States.
Yeah.
Does anybody else stand out that you've met in your lifetime through the work that you do?
I had the opportunity to meet a few different people. Like, you might have as well, but meeting Don Cherry was like,
I've never met Don.
Oh no. So it wasn't as like he was a busy guy and he just breezed right through. But I was like, damn, that's Don Cherry. Yeah. And at the time that was pretty big. I met the Queen.
I met the Queen too.
Nice.
Yeah. what a weird.
But the nicest person, they were also, it was just like a genuine, it was just a moment where they're just meeting everybody and moving on. But the most engaged I ever felt with somebody that you'd consider a celebrity would have been Dolly Parton.
Oh, how special.
It was pretty cool. So I got to meet her twice. I was playing music with drum down in Dollywood for what they call the Festival of the Nations. We were representing Canada. And at the end, they do the big parade, and Dolly would come and the town would go nuts. And she'd come out onto the stage with us and just kind of wave and everybody take pictures. She'd shake a tambourine, and then after that we'd get a group photo, but she would meet us each year. But look you in the eye, even if it was like 17 seconds, she was present in spirit. So it was pretty cool.
What an icon she is.
No one ever has anything bad to say about Dolly Parton.
No.
Nor would they dare if they did.
Her and Sidney Crosby.
Amen.
Maybe they should meet and put something out into the world together.
I don't know what that team collaboration would be.
I'm ready for it.
She'd be funny and he'd be turning red.
Yeah.
Well, and speaking of collaboration, this has kind of become part of your identity, is working with others. So is that something is part of the appeal to the Winter Warmers is that I get to be around these people all the time.
For sure. Like, I totally enjoy the aspect. It's the guest thing started off probably as I find a big band, traveling's expensive. How do I play redundantly? Not redundantly, terrible word. How do I play often in the same area? And the only way to do it is try to offer a different show. And so it started not as a necessity, but as a way to stay actively involved here. But it's become part of the identity for sure. And it's super fun. Like, I don't think I've had, you know, I can't say everybody you love equally. but I can
name the shitty guests.
Yeah, right. All right, turn it down. But there's only been a couple times that myself or anybody in the band has walked away with a bad experience. Like very rarely, I can only recall a couple.
Yeah, well, your family. I mean, families have fights once in a while.
Oh, yeah, well, internal, we're always fighting, you know? Mm. We had helmets and gloves after every show. But it is amazing to the experiences that we get to have. And just all, you know, some people we meet fresh that day, rehearse in the morning and play in the afternoon. And it's a pretty cool way to meet somebody.
Yeah. This is the kind of question, if I were being asked, I would like some more time to think about. So I'm sorry if I'm putting you on the spot. Mm. But how would you describe your band identity?
Well, I've been asked that for years, so, and I still don't have that answer. But the way I kind of like to picture it is like the Roots and Great Big Sea had a baby. Mm. So it's like we got that... as they would say, that East Coast vibe, but I don't think it's necessarily all inherent in the music we do, and we're certainly not playing hip-hop like The Roots, but The Roots is my favorite comparison to a band, to what we're doing. We write our own music, and we record our own music. We're down to be the backing band for somebody else to record or perform, and we're down to find angles to... stay busy. Like we're not on the Jimmy Fallon show, but Call the Winter Warmers, our version of that, or you know, the little festival they did with the little festival I do, Blueberry Jam, we'll compare it to, I'm forgetting what it was, but the thing that they did with Dave Chappelle and all that, the block party maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I feel like what they do, music aside, is closest to what we are trying to do or we're doing. And then you just add, you add a bit of the East Coast touch, and I think you have it.
I think it's almost genius to bring the guests up in that way and be able to play a different show every week, because my band, we can't play in the city every week. We can play twice a year.
Yeah.
Because you can't sell tickets to the same show every month even. Like, you need to be bringing something new. And being able to do that and bring up the different people. And even when you play a song that you would play every week, you have that person on stage adding their elements to it, which makes it different. That is an amazing way to create these opportunities.
Yeah, and we're definitely lucky with that. And in the same spirit, like say if we came back and just did a one-off show, we don't have the effect that we would with the warmer. So
yeah.
Whereas if we're doing that, we do it less because we're built that up on the other side, but it becomes a balance of when we're not doing that, how do we play in the city and when.
Yeah, it's a brilliant business model, and you're not paying for the expense of being on tour all the time either. Although, no. Is that something that you miss?
Well, I never got to tour too much with my own act. I was very, like, I've been lucky. The Bagpipes have opened up so many doors for me. And that's how I got here, doing any of this in the first place, was being able to stand in the background of shows and opportunities I had because of the Bagpipes. So I did drum. I joined, when I went to university, only playing pipes, really, and Celtic piano. And I was like, well, there's no future in music, so I have to do something. And I wanted a future in music, but I didn't have an angle. And while I was there, I had this show called Drum that was from here, a cultural show that represented generally the first founding cultures of Nova Scotia, of course, the Mi'kmaq, then the Acadians and the Celts and the African settlers. And so I played pipes for about a minute and a half in the show in two different parts, maybe 3 minutes. And then a lot of the stuff I was just doing was background percussion. And so I got to do the Olympics in Vancouver, we did the Hollywood. I did Canada Day, Parliament Hill, a couple different years. And that was my first real experience touring. And frankly, everything else has been kind of one-offs since and everything before. I'd say for the most part is because the Pipes, even if they're bringing in Rankin McGinnis to represent Nova Scotia for a tourism show in Toronto, it's still because they're like, you can do that East Coast element.
Yeah.
And so I miss that for sure, but I didn't have the experience that a lot of bands would touring their music.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love to get the band and us at a point where we're doing it. And that is kind of the focus. And with recording and all that, we have ability to at least pitch ourselves further rather than this word of mouth magic we seem to have accomplished here. Mm.
You said earlier that at that point in your life that you told yourself there was no future in music.
Yeah, I got
what would you say to
fast.
That guy now?
Well, I was like, what? Sometimes you talk too long, you forget what your point was. So that guy, hey, he was trying to find his angle then. And even if he was doing other stuff at the same time, he found his angle now. But yeah, what I meant to say with the drum thing was when I really get to stand back in the background and see what these people from Nova Scotia had accomplished getting on those big stages. And like we're BC places, like a 80,000 seater something. It's the big soccer stadium. And you're just looking at that and like, I'm here doing this. But at the same time, I was able to be like, I can build this. I can do this. I can't do it this fast or maybe this big, but I can have an idea that can resonate like this. And it was from those experiences that I ended up coming to Halifax. And it was that guy was a year away from being, I'm going to make a decision to find that angle. So finding it now, so you can tell him now, but he knew it then, I think.
Yeah.
There's a term that often gets thrown around to describe what you do. And I'm going to say it, and I'm not going to call you that, but kitchen party is something that often gets used.
I thought you were going to say hustler.
I thought you know.
but that is, and we talked earlier, you said that's something you've never described yourselves as,
you know,
but everyone else seems to.
You know, I might have said it once or twice. I said I never have, and I can't remember if I can confirm that. But it was never the angle to pitch it like that.
Yeah,
so growing up, we would say Kaylee first.
Yeah.
And then our side is very Gaelic focused. And so Kaylee was the word. Kitchen party was next. And it was more like I felt like a tourism pitch or anglicized version of what we were doing. Aimed at, you know,
the outside world.
Outside world. Outside like when we say kitchen party, like I say we, and I'm assuming we're the same. It meant like it was a kitchen party. It was a house party.
Mm. Yeah.
So a kitchen party for me first is a kitchen party and then down the road event. But before that, Kaylee. But my hesitance to ever use the word for what we're doing is because there's such that East Coast Celtic element that's implied. And it's only defensive in the styling of music that I get like that. Because like, let's just say we do a show and we do 3 minutes of Pipes.
Yeah.
And then we play another 2.5 hours. It's everything from hip hop to Latin to rock to jazz. I think when somebody's using it to describe what we're doing, say if you haven't been before, there's a misconception of what's going on. I think the kitchen party is there in spirit and in the way that I'd mean it, in like in the kitchen of trading music and
songs and ideas. Yeah,
I think that exists, but I just it's the just implying that it's East Coast Celtic, almost touristy show is where I just get defensive of the
word.
For
sure, yeah. And I guess the beauty of describing someone as kitchen party, when you think of the roots of what that is, it's a bunch of people who can play an instrument, maybe passing a guitar around, different people singing songs. And that element of like, the passing off the song is definitely prevalent in what you do. But in terms of, stylistically, you guys can do anything up there. And usually at a Cape Breton kitchen party, you're not hearing Latin-infused songs. Yeah.
Well, you know what? Usually not, but that's the thing. It's funny because like I'm not even, the more I think about it, I'm not defensive of the word kitchen party. I'm defensive of how others might imagine the word kitchen party.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The common perception of that is different than what you do. The energy of a kitchen party is there.
Yeah.
But the, as you said, Mike, the style of it is not limited to what we might think.
Because even if we said it in Cape Breton, you might picture the fiddle, but it might also be someone's drunk uncle's singing Honky Tonk Woman on a guitar.
Well, and you have guest artists everywhere from Jamila to the Town Heroes to like such a spectrum of genres.
I shouldn't be so defensive.
Well, I don't know. You're just clearing the air. Yeah. So how many weeks is the Winter Warmers? It's like 11 or 12?
It was 11 weeks. Usually we start the second week after New Year's and go to whatever the last Saturday of the winter is. This year we started right after, so it's 11. So it's usually around 10 or 11.
So 10 or 11 weeks, 10 or 11 guest artists, and up to 10 musicians on stage at a time who are all working other jobs and playing in other bands. How the hell do you rehearse and prepare?
And Rankin lives in Cape Breton.
How is this logistically even possible?
Again, that engine, the band, like they luckily all buy in. So usually the week that will go for everybody, it would be like we try to get the music as early as we can from people. And sometimes I'm slow asking, sometimes they're slow giving. There's some people that, like, as soon as you ask, they tell you what they want. They send charts. There's some people, you know, I'm guilty of communication for slow responses. But, you know, it's me one thing to do it and another person to do it to me. Come on.
Yeah.
You know, someone would be like, oh, I'll send the tunes tomorrow. And then you wait the day, then the next day you check in. It's like, oh, sorry, forgot. And then it'll be 2 days. But the goal is to have all the music by Sunday, the day before the show. Because it's, you know, we could have it before, but most times people can't learn at 2 weeks in advance when there's another show in between. It's just the way everybody's mentally compartmentalizing. So Sunday the music comes in. Luke Levy will make a document to make it accessible to everybody, one source and also one reference track, say if it was a cover, like to be like, we're learning this one from YouTube. And so it's kind of so he has it all organized, and then Monday till Thursday they'll try to find some time to learn these songs. It's usually about 9 a week, and minimum 6, maximum 12. It can range. And they're And then Friday, we'll get a few of the artists together at Tori's rehearsal spot there. And we'll go through every song twice is what you get to go through. And the next day, we'll do sound check and usually one to two other artists at sound check. And then you get an hour to an hour and 20-minute break and then do the show. So it's a
unreal
full week every week. Sunday, Saturday, it's done. Sunday, the tune's back in, do the recap.
Catch a few Z's.
Yeah.
And this, dear listener, is why Rankin McGinnis has won Entertainer of the Year recently.
Oh, again, that.
You deserve that recognition. Yeah. This is unreal. Because, you know, people go to the show and they get to feel that environment. They're at a sold out marquee show with all of the locals' best talent and featuring new guests every week. But the behind the scenes component, in my eyes, is equally impressive. And that's not what people really are privy to seeing, the level of organization, the commitment even from your bandmates that goes in. And
you know, it's funny because like it's different. Some people see it, some people don't. Most people that aren't involved in the music, I shouldn't say most, but most don't realize the amount of work it does take. But it's funny, like it's almost even funnier when artists don't it's the amount of work it takes. And, you know, tunes coming in on Thursday or a request to change a song on Friday, not realizing.
Right.
It's like 8 to 9 other people that affects.
Yeah.
And like I said, I take it comically, but it's eye-opening for the band when they're taking it on, and it's eye-opening for anybody once they're involved to see, like, geez. Again, like, thank you for the compliment to the entertainer, but again, it's without that engine, without that band, none of this would exist.
I think the music industry is so fascinating in how there's no two paths that are the same.
Yeah.
And you have this massive focus on live performance. Like you're performing every week, and then you're bringing in these guests. You have all these elements of creating this massive live performance. And some people just record music and put it out, or just write, or have a combination of different things. And I think that's just an amazing thing about being a musician, is you can find what really works for you and go towards that and really focus on that. And it seems like you have really found that the live performance is a major thing for you, but you are in the studio right now working on some tracks as well.
Yeah, so I think that's part of how I grew up too, though. It was live performance only. There wasn't a recording culture around.
Yeah.
But it's always been the intention, and finally now had a little bit of time to do some recording with Party Boots, but this is kind of the first time I've ever been able to record myself.
Yeah. And that will open up a lot more doors as well for the live performance.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty exciting. It's pretty fun to be doing.
Tell us about Blueberry Jam.
So Blueberry Jam, the event that's held in Malibu, co-hosted with Big Bell Farm, Paul and Adele Marr. It started with, they bought a beautiful, beautiful old farm in Malibu, a heritage farm, over 100 years old. They're big music supporters, and I didn't really know them from Malibu, but I would have known them, meeting them through live events. I think they were kind of just watching me from a distance, being involved with like Bruce Guthrie, Stomp and all that. Just not heavily involved at all, but always a part of it. And then at the time with Party Boots, doing my effort to build up events, like we would, same idea where we wanted to stay busy and find an angle. Like we would curate a St. Patrick's Day or whatever, Halloween, different style events, and they came to a St. Patrick's Day one and basically told me that they wanted to start something, a concert at their place, and asked if I had any interest. And at the time, I really wasn't sure, because I was like, okay, if I do this, this is a lot of work. And because once you take something on, you're responsible for not just organizing and all that, but actually ensuring there's a profit. And to set up at a place that's not a venue already is thousands of dollars out of the gate, and then you add on acts and facilities and all that. So I didn't think too seriously about it until I finally went and visited, and I saw the land, and I was like, okay, I'm in. No matter if it takes a few years, we can do something here for sure. So it all started out of an invitation to come in and join in. And so they have, not there, but they have blueberry farms near there, blueberry fields near there. And they wanted, Paul wanted to have some recognition to the blueberry industry of Nova Scotia. So from that, I would play it around and came up with the Blueberry Jam, and the name couldn't have worked out better for everybody.
Yeah.
But it started out of invitation, started one day concert, turned into a weekend small festivals concert weekend. And then during COVID, we had added a second thing where the Harvest Series, which would be over Thanksgiving weekend, where you'd come in to the barn versus using it as the backdrop of the stage and do like a smaller concert series over Thanksgiving weekend.
And the Blueberry Jam has grown significantly too.
Yeah.
Like I think played the second one. And that was during COVID, so there certainly were restrictions in that.
COVID year one.
And remember I think you put chalk down to create the sections you were allowed to be in.
Yeah,
then played last year as well, and that was rocking, man. That was, I don't know what your numbers are, if you were even allowed to have more than that. But that was quite an atmosphere.
Yeah.
Quite a just experience. Everybody there is just absolutely loving everything that's happening. And there's an energy in the air that only happens at special things.
That was a super special one. And you also did one of the Harvest Series ones too.
Yes.
And that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
That was Rocket Two, just not as many.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was but the Blueberry Jam this year was super special. And so the amount of people, we could be allowed more, but we'll actually meet and talk about that very soon. But it's just how many people do they want on that land before it really impacts the land is where we're trying to find the number. And also everybody that's been coming for years likes to, nobody wants it to be too big where you lose the magic, the feeling of that shared community.
Yeah.
And for you to have described, the reason that you agreed to do this was because you stepped foot on that land. And that was the convincing point
And
its magic.
It still could have happened regardless, but without knowing, you know, what you're walking into beforehand, it was hard to imagine. Yeah. But as soon as, like I said, it was.
How do you both deal with that very, I guess, realization as musicians, knowing if they could just hear this show, if they could just listen to this song, if they could just be part of this audience? Because part of our job as artists is marketing ourselves, whether we like it or not. And knowing that you've got a great performance, a great product, and the barrier is people just hearing it or being part of that community. Like, you were maybe a no or a I'm not sure until you experienced being on that land.
Yeah.
So it's no different than somebody hearing your music or being to your show for the first time and being like, oh. So how are you mentally managing trying to build an audience, trying to promote yourself, trying to put yourself out there in this vulnerable way constantly, both of you?
I think it's just about believing in yourself and your songs and what it is you're creating, because there are times when, everything isn't exactly how you want it to be. But if you have that strong belief in what you're doing, and like, I know that this song, if the right people find it, there is that audience, or whatever it may be, or if the word of mouth spreads about this festival, it's going to be packed. Like, as long as you have that belief, you can certainly keep going. And if you're working hard, have that belief, and you're putting your energy into it, I feel like good things will happen no matter what.
Yeah, I'd say I'm with that. I'd say I'm very motivated by getting stuff done, or something has to be fixed. Like, it was kind of funny at the Blueberry Jam when it rained on the Friday night. Mm. You know, some people might have, you know, like, some people panic right away. But me and Paul, that's what was fun. We might butt heads all the time just because we're too hard-headed skulls and
two Cape Breton men.
But but when things, like, something goes wrong, we're both like, all right, like, it's almost like, yes, you're not like saying yes in your head, but it's more like, all right, let's accomplish this. So, like, I anything that has to get done, whether it's the event or the song, like, I can focus 100% on it until I'm happy with it. And whether it goes to the moon or not, it's more like, I have no problem with this product. I have no problem listening to this product. I have no problem showing up to this product, paying for this. Like, and same with merch. Like, it's like, would I buy that?
Yeah.
If not, like, even if I made it, you gotta ignore it if it wasn't good enough. But where I get stressed is the management of communication and the management of, like you said, people asking for things. Like, you want to say yes to everybody, and say if there's something you don't want to do or can't do. Like, I almost shut down instead of saying no. So I can handle anything that has to be accomplished, but any hard conversation is what, in our world, it's what my hardest.
Do you have a manager or
no?
Someone?
I'm a stupid cowboy.
Do you want one?
I'd say, like, I know I could be proactive in trying to find the right match and pitching myself, but I'm always behind on the things that have to be currently accomplished, that I can't really seem to find the time to organize facilitating that. However, I shouldn't even say management, but there's just, of late, there'd be different people expressing ability to be involved on the team. And if it works out, you know, of course, I put a huge value in incentive. Somebody that's actually wanting to be there, approaching you, whether it's like they see what you're doing already, and I don't see it like that. I see they see that it could go somewhere, like, or they could take it further. So I don't have anybody on the team yet, but besides the band, and then I guess Alex Mead would be my recording team man since Party Boots. Anything I've ever done was with Alex. But besides that, any other hat I'd be wearing myself. But yeah, I would love management or booking agents, anybody, pad my pockets.
What do you do in your life to recharge energy or just separate from the music scene for a minute?
Well, I'm in Halifax half the time. When I'm in Halifax, I'm living like a musician, or at least like the movie version, where it's like you're in the studio or playing, and if not, you're at the local, and the local could be a reference to any movie bar, but it's pretty much Halifax's movie bar.
Yeah.
And so when I'm here, I'm always hustling, bustling. But then when I'm home, which is currently in Banyan, I'm in the woods on the Bador beside the mountain there. And I've not taken enough of the walks up the mountain, but I'm completely in nature, and it's so I recoup like that. But I can't, we have to learn so much music. I don't really listen to music anymore.
Yeah.
And so I'll just put on in the background, even like while I'm playing or practicing, I just put on movies that I've seen before. So I just turn into an old man in the woods. Mm.
This is how I create too. I put on old like 80s TV or something I don't really have to pay attention to.
Yeah.
And I know, Mike, you've talked about I can't really listen to music for pleasure in the same way I once did. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's exceptions to that, but this is a relatable thing amongst us.
There's only like two artists. So I find like I got it when we all listen to music in different forms now, and I'm an Apple Music guy, not because I like it more than Spotify, but when I had this years and years and years and years of investment into a music library, and it's all on iTunes, and it goes over to Apple Music. It started like that, but the way the library is, like, I'll go and it's your recently added stuff, and that's what I'll listen to, like the same song over and over again, the small amount of time, and then I got sick of it. And those periods, it would be Merle Haggard or George Jones of the last year. But I found now, instead of listening to music, I'll just get obsessively hooked on somebody for a period of time. Like, there's a band called the Fleece Brothers, and it was the first group since like I was a kid, and like Bob Dylan going through his old anthology, or funny enough, Jack Johnson, and just weird periods of time I latch onto something. But it was during COVID, it was the first time I fell in love with like an act or an artist instead of just a song again. And just recently, this guy named Zach Top, he's like a 24-year-old country guy,
okay,
but it's like 1993. It's like it could be. He's got a voice like Vince Gill, like super, super smooth, but it could be like Alan Jackson, Garth Brooks, Brooks and Dunn kind of recording. Mm-hmm. And so as someone who doesn't listen anymore, only in the last month have I found an artist that I'm like, I can't stop playing.
He's your guy.
He's my guy right now.
It's hard this day and age. People don't really listen to a full album, like myself included. And I guess it sounds like you're kind of describing that, where you hear a single and you might like, oh, that song's awesome, and you throw that into a playlist or something.
Yeah.
And then you have this big mishmash of different songs, and sometimes like, oh, I love this song, and you don't even know who the artist is because you just maybe Shazammed it or something.
Exactly.
And you add it to a playlist. And I don't think that's a great thing, because we're not giving the appreciation to the artist. And as a musician myself, like, I want people to listen to my full album. Like, their songs are structured that way for a reason. Like, this song goes after this one because of this. And I think it's nice that you're finding artists where you can actually appreciate them in that way.
Oh, yeah. It's a major difference. And it's funny when you notice that you stopped doing it, so you actually extra appreciate when you get into it. It's funny you said about even the playlist, or you pick the order of songs on an album and all this. Like, when I do Blueberry Jam or Winter Warmers, I always make a playlist, and I put so much time into the order of the stuff. Yeah. My brother was like, goes, you know,
people only listen on shuffle anyways.
You forget about that aspect of it. It's like, yeah, all that time for just me.
Do you think like this digital age with attention spans kind of decreasing and people maybe not paying as much attention as they once did, does that make the winter warmers and the shows you're putting on all that more special, where you have X amount of people in one place, one moment in history, they're all just enjoying life?
Definitely. Definitely. Like, it's funny to think of as a 35-year-old, as a young dinosaur, but I think we grew up, of course, just the last culture that remembers before internet and after internet. But we also are from the last culture that's really from before computer production and post-computer production and before tracks and not live tracks.
Yeah.
So it's rarer to see a full band that's, like back in the day, we were as electric as can be, but in this day and age, it's presented almost not acoustically, but it's like we were referring to an electric guitar as a natural instrument.
Yeah,
and they're still there, but everything's based around defined structure. Almost everybody's show, and not to take away from anybody that isn't doing that.
Yeah,
but on the biggest of the stages, or even the medium big stages. And so to have the Winter Warmers with the live band, to have all these guests and doing these things and doing it off the cuff, and we always want to be perfect, but allowing for these mistakes, it is really special. And it does feel like it won't be a thing that's going to be around or easily around. Mm. Like even, pick another big band, the Mellotones, and all of us are, going to move on from this earth someday, but I don't see anybody, the Mellotones 20 years ago, there could have been a few Mellotones around, right? But when's the next time we're going to see a band that good playing with that kind of style of music? Everything comes back, but the having big bands, having all natural instruments is becoming a rare thing, and I feel very lucky to be one of them doing it.
Yeah, a lot of trends in modern music. Again, younger bands, you're definitely hearing the tracks in there. Right?
Yeah, and it kind of actually opens up it. I think, I don't know for sure, but like punk in a way is kind of coming back because of that, but that's still, usually small size bands, and it is kind of cool to see just the contrast of that versus like the extreme other end that a lot of the music went. But
well, a lot of very famous, I guess you could say, movements in music have been as a response to something, right?
Yeah, there you go.
Like the grunge era became a response to kind of 80s stuff that people didn't really appreciate that much. It was just more, let's put some edge back into it.
It's funny, like people always say it's the worst decade, but it's also probably realistically the best decade. It's like 70s and 60s all still existed, 80s existed, hip hop was created, and then like that whole response to the stuff they hated before, like everything existed at once. The only thing we were missing was just like deeper produced pop.
But that's the overlooked aspect of art often, and certainly 80s art, is this is a response to what we don't like, rather than it being the birth of something brand new all the time. Like that response is the birth of something new, but it's not really talked about in that way. We just kind of glaze over the 80s for bad fashion and haircuts.
Did you guys watch that thing about We Are the World?
I saw it on Netflix. I didn't watch it.
Oh my God,
though.
I finally watched it. It was worth the watch.
Yeah.
But it was funny to see like it response of what people don't like. One of the things that bothered me, even though I was just a young person at the time, was like that room, how as prestigious it was. And then there was like a bit about Cyndi Lauper, and I forget who she said it to, but it was like, some of the big names.
Yeah.
And like, oh, my boyfriend says, like, it was to Lionel Richie. It's like, my boyfriend says that I shouldn't do the song. It's like, he thinks it's not cool and it's going to be a flop, blah, blah, blah. But it was just crazy to see like that 80s edge.
Yeah.
Young, like, probably one of the youngest artists in the room of extreme legends, and just being like, oh no, you guys aren't cool enough. But speaking of the art of what we don't like, and you know, the hair going the different direction and all that.
What do you think, like, younger bands playing to tracks think of bands like yourself or mine, like, who don't have tracks playing live?
I don't have anything against it.
No, I don't either.
I just appreciate that we can do it without it. And some shows, you know, it's necessity, and like, that's when I feel like the show can become, or should become, more of a show than a concert. It's like, if it's scripted, then like, script it all, script the lights, script the choreography. And I don't think they necessarily think anything bad of what we're doing, and for the most part they're probably, you know, like, wish that I wouldn't even call it younger bands, but like, you know, might wish that they'd had the opportunity to have a bigger band to do that stuff, or they just might be like, where's the Sonic? We're missing some of the Sonic low. And I don't know.
Just wonder if they're the Cyndi Laupers and we're the Lionel Richies, and they're like, looking at us. Like,
well, yeah, definitely.
But maybe you guys should explain, in case there's someone listening, like, what is it? What do you mean by a track, and what's the purpose of it? Like, why would that be used as a tool?
Well, for the most part, it's to enhance the song that they're doing live, and it's cost efficient. Like, say it's, you know, it is a smart thing to do. I can't go on tour with this act unless I'm funded, or unless I take off and can make serious money somewhere else. So say if I was going somewhere, it would be in my benefit to maybe have one other person I play music with, and have a show design where there's tracks running that bring
to, like, pre-recorded
so,
of your songs.
Songs. So it could be, sometimes it could just be harmony, sometimes it could be a whole track with drums and bass. It's like, what are you missing? But for the most part, it's to sonically enhance your performance without having somebody play it live.
Okay. So I hear that, and I see the benefit of that would allow me to amp up my performance, my showmanship, so to speak. But it also would remove the element of improv, or like moving with a room or working with a room, would it not?
And I think it actually might depend on the program. So for the most part, it would be, if you wanted a solo section that had to be planned. But then there's other people that have it where it's like, it's there's way more science and talent to it. Kind of like as somebody who doesn't DJ, to take away from DJs, but you know, you get the guys, the old heads would be like, he ain't DJing. Where's his real records?
Right.
And that takes more talent, blah, blah, blah. And truthfully, I don't know if it does or doesn't. It's a different style
of talent.
However, there's people that would, hey, often the drummer would be captaining this, but they could be like, have a trigger that will go on to the next section. So you can have something that could stay open-ended, and then you'd have to be coordinated to hit a button to move. So there still is the ability to be creative with it, depending on the system you're using it and who's implementing it. But for the most part, it is, you know, our accepted version of Villy Manilli.
And every single major pop band you would hear in the world would be doing it.
Yeah. Like, the ones that are successful would be like, you guys are idiots for
for, like, not doing, like, this.
We were at the Juno dress rehearsal, and we saw a number of performances. And the thing is, most people in the audience don't even know what a track is, I guess. That's why you were asking for us to explain it. But you see a band up there, and like, Charlotte Cardin had a drummer and a bass player on stage with her. Where's the rest of the music coming from?
Yeah.
So she's playing the tracks. Like, that's, but she can tour with two people and have this massive sound that's very going to sound the same every night. Like, she knows that her backing vocalists aren't going to have a cold and not be able to sing. Like, it's already pre-recorded. It's already in there. And again, most of the audience doesn't know this.
Mm-hmm.
It's just they're seeing this show that they love and enjoy. And it's still like she's likely still singing. And I think, I don't know.
Yeah.
For the most part, there is some live instrumentation there. And it makes things, like Rankin said, much more efficient for touring. You can.
Yeah. And it's kind of like the Super Bowl, where it's like there's artists that normally do this and then there's artists that don't. But the Super Bowl, everybody has to be, it has to be pre-recorded, because it's, and you know, and maybe you can make the same argument for these big shows, Taylor Swift or whoever else. It's like nothing can go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It has to go right. And for the consumer, you know, that's should be the case in general. But as you know, like us, like if something goes wrong, if the sound goes funny, you know, it's almost like, you know, those things happen at live shows all the time. And it's like when it gets fixed, it's kind of like, oh, right, that rock and roll, we're back. So it does add an element of charm, have things that can go wrong. You know, one of my favorite things that happens at the time, even though it's not good for the show, is like, say if I'm singing and I, it happens all the time, I take the mic out of the stand and I pop the XLR off. And then it becomes, what do I do? Can I get back together? Do I run over to somebody else's mic? And you kind of make a show of the things that go wrong.
Yeah. I love those types of things. The magic that can happen in a show, like whatever, someone's playing a solo and someone jumps up on stage and something happens, this moment is created. I feel like those, like you said, you can still create those moments in a synced show, a pre-recorded thing, but there's a lot more spontaneity when you're playing as a live band, and you can extend parts and add different things in, or elements that no one was expecting, not even the people playing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a little bit of magic that I find can be lost in those choreographed ones, but you can also add in like very specific light shows. And
it depends on what your goal is as an artist. Like Taylor Swift is there to entertain, and her audience is expecting the same show that they saw in Spain 2 weeks ago. Like maybe a couple tracks will be different, or that they're going to see in Canada next week. Like there's a rhythm to that business model. And I think this conversation about backing tracks is so relevant right now, because we're entering this era of tech. I mean, that's booming. And I think about this a lot with my gallery. I have a small community gallery in a otherwise abandoned church in the middle of nowhere that 50 people can go to at once. I see that as so important right now, because we are in this era of everything being so tech driven. I like this idea of bringing community together, much like you're doing. But I also realize that there's an opportunity to use digital or tech that will invite other people in to have a different experience in that very same space. So I guess for you as the artist or performers, entertainers, it depends on what you want to achieve with that show.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a spectacle with choreographed dance or lighting or something, like probably the track then becomes a necessary tool.
Yeah. And like, and sometimes it's not even just that. Sometimes it's like, I'm a singer, I don't have a band.
Yeah.
This is what I can do. Like there's no judgment. It's more just preference.
Yeah.
And it all came back to liking the ability that we do have a big band and we don't do it. But for the most part, with the artists that we work with at Warmers, I'd say a lot of, you know, unless, of course, the ones in the bands, but most of them are individuals. Brett Matthews, Nicole Ariana, Leanne Hoffman, like some might have a band sometimes, but for the most part, like they'll have to be like, how do I run this on my own?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So,
yeah,
that's how.
Well, now I understand. We all learn something.
What's next for Rankin? You got the recording.
Trying to get in
Blueberry Jam.
First album done, Blueberry Jam. And then after that, you know, a couple more things and we're back into the Warmers again. I think for me, it's perfecting this balance of the Warmers and Blueberry Jam, and what can I do in between, mm-hmm. and what else can we do
But before anything, like I spent 10 years getting my foot in the door and the events to where they are that right now it's like, let's record and let me learn about the studio and let me learn about the release. It's one thing to record. It's another thing to finish it. It's even more to be like, how do I put this out there and gain any traction and not just do this for mom?
Yeah, it's all back to the many different sides and avenues of the music industry, right?
Yeah.
And I think this is going to open so many more doors for you.
Yeah,
and
I hope so.
Take you down some amazing paths.
Yeah.
Do you have a name for the album or release date, like details around this part, or you're not there yet?
No, I wish. Our intention was we had a song that's ready to be put out. It is called Bring It Home, but it's a very, very good song. And like originally our intention was put out a couple singles, maybe put out an EP or two EPs, and then maybe an album. But at this point, it's like we have about, like Luke has about two or three songs. Like one thing cool about this project is even though everything's under my own name, it's still going to be the same project that Luke will record under his name within Release Music. And I believe Tori, the same thing. And so they each have a couple songs that we could be putting down. And then I have about 20 songs that were never recorded. We won't record that many, but it's right now we have about 9-10 that really fit this folk pop vibe. And instead of doing an EP, it's like, let's just do an album. Let's get our first album done and out there and then attack the rest. So it went from intending to release the single very soon to, let's do an album and maybe, you know, Bring It Home could be the name of the album. It's a great song, could be a good title, but I'm not, you know, jinx, knock on wood, whatever else. I'm not ready to make a decision on that yet and see how all the other recordings come out and kind of make more of a plan of release once we hear everything.
Well, you're a man who has taken on big undertakings in his lifetime, so
yeah,
I'm
have
sure
a couple
this will
days
be...
off. Let's do an album.
There you go. A couple days rest. Pump
and
that out.
You know, musicians' hockey is back too, eh?
I heard. I'm gonna have to find reasons to be here on a Tuesday.
Yeah. Musicians' hockey is
musicians' hockey. Yeah. Hey, I'm in.
All right, buddy. Well, yeah. Congrats on all the success, and yeah, it's only growing from here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for squeezing us in. We're just so, so proud of you and all the work you've put out, and just huge congrats on the new album, and can't wait to see where it takes you next, bud.
Thank you very much.
All right, cheers, everyone.
Cheers, bud.
Cheers.
There you go, Rankin McGinnis. What a gem.
What a gem. What a guy. And he's working on new tunes all the time.
Yeah.
In the studio now. That's going to be a fun project for him.
Yeah, he's... like we talked about in the interview, he's done a lot of live stuff, like very, very often. They're a live band that's playing all the time, and he obviously has stuff recorded as well, but he wants to up his game and get some awesome sounding stuff down to tape and put it out to the world.
Yeah, well, we artists have to diversify. It's nice to be in new environments once in a while.
For sure.
Yeah, so anything exciting on the horizon for you that you want to talk about?
Well, we have something special cooking up between the Town Heroes, my band, and the Curiosity Club, your club.
Yes, my club. It's kind of my band, my version of the band.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So we'll just say for now, keep your eyes on those social media accounts, because there's going to be something very fun revealed next Sunday or Monday. Yeah,
and
coming up.
As far as maybe it's happened somewhere, but I've never seen this thing happen ever in history anywhere.
Nor have I. That's the beauty of Curiosity Club and the creativity that we bring. But yeah, we'll leave it at that because there's lots more to come about this reveal, but something very special in the works.
Okay, folks, thanks for tuning in. Lots more to come. Subscribe, tell your friends, give us a review. The highest we ever hit in the world was number 36, and we're pretty proud of that number. 36 is a decent place to get to, but we're always trying to get higher, so the more you spread the word, the more it grows, and maybe we'll crack that top 25 soon.
We're always aiming for the best, aren't we?
Let's do it.
Yeah. Thanks, everyone. See you next week.
Cheers.